It's Economics 101, gang. Tariffs can be raised, yes. They can be lowered, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 12th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is a truism of economics that the thing that bites you often isn't what you think is going to bite you. It's the thing you don't see coming, the unintended consequence. To that end, a new report out from the Peterson Institute for International Economics on the U.S.-China trade war. Of course, China has indeed raised tariffs on American products, Peterson points out, but at the same time, tariffs on those same kinds of products, but made not here, have been lowered. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
With one hand, China is closing the door to U.S. products. With the other, it is opening the door to U.S. competitors in the rest of the world. Chad Bown is with the Peterson Institute.
So if you're Canadian or Japanese or German and you want to sell your product into China, there's a really good chance you now face a lower tariff than you did a year ago. And it's a much lower tariff, of course, than what the equivalent American would have to pay.
Chinese tariffs on U.S. products have increased to 42% on average. Everyone else just pays 19% on average, says Bown. But lowering tariffs on the rest of the world is not just about retaliation against the U.S.
This broader trend has been underway for quite some time.
Lauren Glatterman is with the Rhodium Group. China's economy has been slowing for internal reasons, financial system reforms that were a tough pill to swallow. Improving access to cheap foreign goods helps the Chinese economy cope with both the slowdown and the trade conflict.
In this context, it makes sense to do whatever you can.
Whatever China's reasons, the consequence is simple. Disruption.
This is just going to lead to a broader decoupling of supply chains between the U.S. and China.
Marika Heller is with the Albright Stonebridge Group. As the U.S. and Chinese economies disentangle, accelerated by different levels of tariffs, it will be difficult for some U.S. and Chinese companies to adapt. Some cases are already on display. The American lobster industry lost 70% of its exports when Chinese tariffs went up. The competing Canadian lobster industry's exports doubled as Chinese tariffs for them went down. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So here's a real estate term that'll strike fear into the hearts of those who remember the run-up to the housing crash. House flipping. Anybody remember that? It's in the program today because the big investment firm KKR is doubling its investment in a company that buys loans that are made to those who flip. All told, KKR is pitching in $500 million. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on there.
For one, there are still lots of fixer-uppers that are ripe for flipping. And with home prices so high, there's a lot of money to be made buying the fixer-upper, rehabbing it, and selling for a profit.
You can buy low and sell high.
Bridget Brust owns Space & Company, a real estate broker in Philadelphia. About 20% of her business involves flipping. And for her, right now, it's going well.
It seems like it's a better time to flip than I've seen in the last 5 years.
Brust says her company makes a 15 to 20% profit on its flipping deals. The hottest markets for this, says Wharton School real estate professor Susan Wachter, cities like Philadelphia with a lot of older houses.
Where there is job growth, where talent is moving. So this is an easy, natural market for making money.
In fact, about 11% of home sales in the last quarter of 2018 were flips, according to CoreLogic. That means they were bought and sold within 2 years. CoreLogic Deputy Chief Economist Ralph McLaughlin says there's still risk in flipping. In fact, flippers are losing money in some West Coast cities where home price growth has been cut in half. He says in places like Seattle and San Jose,
the share of flips that are losing money is approaching about the 20 to 30% mark.
McLaughlin says corporations were behind more than 40% of flip sales at the end of last year, a record high, and they may have more of a financial cushion to weather downturns in the housing market. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
House flipping isn't the only business KKR has taken an interest in. Toys R Us, anyone? Nabisco, perhaps? A brief look at the history of the very expensive deals that firm has been a part of lives at marketplace.org. So there we were browsing the MIT Technology Review this morning, as one does, when we came across this. A bunch of recent studies looking at the carbon emissions that artificial intelligence, cryptocurrency mining, even streaming music can put into the atmosphere. Think electricity generation on those. Training a typical artificial intelligence model, for instance, emits as much carbon as do five cars. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has that one.
Let's start with Bitcoin. Creating and managing the virtual currency requires a lot of computing power, which uses a lot of electricity. Chris Stoll at the Technical University of Munich calculated how much CO2 that leads to. It's 22 megatons per year.
This level of emission compares to small nations like the countries of Jordan and Sri Lanka.
Just because you're not a cryptocurrency nerd doesn't mean you're off the hook. Emma Strubel at the University of Massachusetts Amherst trains the AI models that power voice assistants like Siri and Alexa. She was surprised by the impact of the computer servers she uses.
The carbon footprint of the research and development of my most recent paper easily more than doubled my personal carbon footprint last year.
Servers in data farms are the cloud. Click play on a streaming music service and you're actually requesting a data file from a server somewhere in the world. The companies which host the cloud are very aware of their environmental impact. Amazon Web Services, for example, plans to move to 100% renewable energy. If the industry maintains a focus on clean energy, Neil Elliott of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy says there's not too much to worry about.
This is something in which the benefits may outweigh the environmental and energy costs that are associated with them.
Nobody is suggesting that we stop using cloud computing, just that we all need to be more aware of its impact. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, oh, hello, budget deficit, tariffs, and that macroeconomic reality. On Wall Street today, down-ish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were treated to the latest figures on inflation today, the Consumer Price Index, it's called, up just a 0.1% in May from a month earlier, a 1.8% gain over a year ago, just about what everybody had been guessing. Does kind of put the Fed in a bit of a jam interest rate-wise, because now what do they do with inflation flat? But for consumers, same-same on prices is pretty good. That said, our listeners are still thinking a whole lot about what they are spending their money on.
My name is Kaya Price Dennis. I'm calling from Short Pump, Virginia. I have seen prices increase in my area, particularly with gas and groceries. I have two premium cars that take now about $120 to fill up, where a couple months ago it was between $85 and $90. I'm not concerned or alarmed. I'm just being more cautious. I'm trying to make the gas last longer because that is my major extra expenditure at this time. But yeah, it's hitting close to home now.
Hey, Marketplace. This is Michael Devitt in Boise, Idaho. Consumer prices, at least what I've noticed, have been quite steady. But some of the staples in our home, at any rate, like coffee and almonds and some of the things that we will buy differently based on price, the prices are down on all of those. So that's been kind of a pleasant surprise.
Hi, Marketplace. This is Ellen Murphy, and I live in Mission Hills, Kansas. Well, it's finally summer here in Kansas and Missouri, and we are looking forward to the farmers markets. Right now, we have Southern State peaches for $1.49 a pound. I'm hoping that we have a long season so that we are not going to suffer too many of the effects of the floods that we've had here.
I am Kelsey Sproul, calling from Iowa City, Iowa. So we bought our house last spring, moved in last summer. We loved the corner lot, but it didn't have a fence. And because we have two little kids and a yellow lab, we knew that that was going to be a problem we needed to fix in short order. The materials cost was not that high for a fence the size that we needed, but the labor costs were much higher than we expected. We were looking at probably somewhere between $4,000 to $6,000 to maybe $8,000 to have the fence put in. Yeah, we didn't want to have to spend that much money for a fence. So we decided to do it ourselves. now we have this beautiful fence, and we were able to save about $6,000.
That was Kaya Price Dennis calling in from Short Pump, Virginia, Michael DeVitt in Boise, Idaho, Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas, and Kelsey Sproul in Iowa City, Iowa. We cover the ins and outs of retail on this program, so regular listeners will know that the past couple of years has been difficult for that slice of this economy. Here with one possible reason why. People of a certain Gen Z, millennial-ish age just don't want to own stuff anymore. So they rent furniture and outdoor gear, kitchen appliances, and obstacle courses for your dog. Sapna Maheshwari covers retail for the New York Times. She wrote about the rental phenomenon. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, would you then, who are these super renters?
So the super renters I talked to for this story are pretty much in their late 20s or early 20s and 30s. And they tend to live in cities. They're college educated and they want nice stuff, but they don't want to buy it.
This is too grand a word, right? But what's the ideological underpinning here?
I think the reasons that people are renting this kind of stuff vary, but for the most part, they really want access to nice items, whether it's furniture or designer clothing, but they don't want the credit card debt attached to that, and they don't want to pay full price for it. They're searching more for an experience and knowing now that they can experience an item without buying it.
Right, and then give it back at the end of whatever short period of time they choose to be with it, right?
Exactly. And that's where this kind of renting really differs from, say, an Airbnb or traditional sharing economy models. Here you have a whole bunch of companies that are centralizing all of this. So they're sending out the items, cleaning it, and shipping it along to the next person.
And we are talking everything here from clothing, right? Rent the Runway, you talk about in this piece, but also like coffee tables and couches and, just stuff.
Exactly. There's West Elm Furniture, Crate and Barrel Furniture, CB2, Vitamixes, REI has gone in on this, and they're really trying to expand their rental services so you can borrow camping gear, backpacks, and who knows what else going forward.
What's your sense, though, of once these 20s and maybe early 30s folks are no longer 20s and early 30s, are they still going to want to be living this way? I mean, your opening paragraph has this life of non-ownership these people have adopted. Is that going to change once they, settle down, I guess?
I suspect it will. And I think that is an important point to make about this piece is the fact that these people aren't married right now. They aren't ready to buy a house. Maybe they can't afford to buy a house right now. So to see people respond in this way and open up this new part of the market is really fascinating.
Not to make it all macroeconomic here, but part of this is a result of what happened in the Great Recession, right? Home ownership is down. People feel more vulnerable. They haven't been able to get the start on life. And so they don't have necessarily the X thousands of dollars to drop on a West Elm couch to begin with.
Yes, I think that's totally true. Right. And we're seeing the effects of that. And of course, we have to acknowledge that this is a generation with a lot of student loan debt. Right. It varied for the people I talked to. Some of those who are living like this actually have no student loan debt. But you can imagine for those that do you really want to throw a couch, into the mix of monthly payments you're making?
Right. Sapna Maheshwari, she's a business reporter at the New York Times, writing about super renters, I guess they're called. Sapna, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I mean, I'm sure like after this press tour, when I go back, it'll be different than before I left.
You leave San Francisco for even a second these days, it changes before you get back. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 43 points today, nearly 0.2%, 26,004. The NASDAQ off 29 points, almost 0.4% there, 77.92. The S&P 500 down 5 points, about 0.2%, 28.79. After a down day yesterday, Beyond Meat surged nearly 13% today on news that Tim Hortons, the Canadian coffee and donuts chain, is rolling out Beyond Meat breakfast sandwiches across Canada. The stock is up more than fivefold since its IPO last month. Barbie toy maker Mattel gained more than 5% today after it rejected a takeover bid by the Bratz doll maker MGA Entertainment. Hasbro up 1% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace. You know, Marketplace is a source you trust for information about the economy and how it affects our lives. We're also a nonprofit news organization, and we are counting on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Any donation helps, but if you give $30 right now, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by another one of our generous supporters, the Candida Fund. Please become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The way houses get bought and sold in this economy has been the same, well, for a very long time. You hire a broker, you set your price, you wait for an offer. Maybe you wait some more. And then when it's done, the broker split their 6%. Or maybe you skip all that and accept an instant cash offer from the disruptors. Companies like Opendoor, OfferPad, Zillow as well, that have started buying homes in certain cities just about on the spot. That convenience comes at a price, yes, but as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, a surprising number of people are willing to pay it.
Aaron and Audie Woods were in a hurry to get to Colorado. They were moving here with a group of families from Texas to start a new church. They'd found a house they wanted to buy in Parker, outside Denver. But first, they had to sell their house in Houston.
One of my friends at our church mentioned Opendoor as an option, and I had never heard of it.
Opendoor is what's known as an iBuyer. The I stands for instant. Woods gave it a try, but thought the offer was too low. OfferPad, a competitor, offered $220,000.
It was obviously less than what I felt like we could get.
He was thinking $235,000.
But it was close enough to where the hassle of trying to list it and show it.
And we did pick our closing date, and we also had to close on our house here in Denver within a month. So it was nice to have that peace of mind that it was sold.
iBuyers have been around for about 5 years now, and their numbers are growing. Traditional brokers like Keller Williams have jumped in, along with startups with names like Knock and Perch. But they're still operating in just a few dozen cities, like Atlanta, Phoenix, and Vegas, where markets are active and homes are similar and easy to value. Mike DelPretti researches real estate tech at the University of Colorado Boulder. He says iBuyers only bought and sold about 25,000 homes last year.
For all of 2018, it was 0.2% of national transactions.
But he expects the number to rise. And if you've ever sold a house, you may have a good idea of why. The tyranny of the open house.
If you have kids, it's kind of a pain to get them out of the house every time you have to do a showing.
The family dog.
I've heard that pet owners are big customers, you know, because they don't want to have to worry about cleaning the carpets or replacing the carpets.
The repairs, the enhancements. Renee Williams also lives in Parker and recently sold her 19-year-old home to Zillow.
My home had the original roof, which did need to be replaced.
So did the carpeting and the oak kitchen cabinets.
Which is no longer the fashion trend, though that's what I love.
Stainless steel appliances and quartz countertops are what buyers love, especially when they're spending $600,000.
And quite frankly, I didn't want to do those upgrades, especially when those aren't upgrades that I would choose for myself.
Zillow offered Williams about $575,000, minus repairs and a service fee. She thinks she paid about 10 grand more than if she'd sold the traditional way.
But I did not have to have anybody come traipsing through my house. I didn't have to worry about offers falling through.
Now Zillow has to worry about that. DelPretti says iBuyers typically sell quickly and make 3 to 5% on the sale. But flipping houses is only part of the business model.
Zillow's only buying 2.5% of the houses that it gets an offer request for. So that other 98%, those are people that are pretty interested in selling their house.
And those are lucrative leads that Zillow and other iBuyers can sell to real estate agents. The Woods family from Texas is settling into their new house in Parker. Their Houston house is under contract for $12,000 more than OfferPad gave them.
But it was on the market for a few months, and we couldn't wait that long.
Plus, even with the discount, they'd been in their house long enough to make a pretty good profit. In Parker, Colorado, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's all kinds of change happening in San Francisco, a lot of it driven by the new money in that city. New buildings, neighborhoods changing, also the people who live in those neighborhoods. Almost 40 years ago, in the 1980 census, African Americans were 12.4% of the population. By 2010, less than 6%. Jimmy Fails was born and raised in San Francisco. He also stars in a new movie inspired by his life, or more specifically, inspired by his childhood home, an old Victorian owned by his grandfather his family could not afford to keep. The film is called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It picked up a couple of big awards at Sundance. It goes into wide release this month. Jimmy Fails came into the studio the other day. First thing I need you to do is tell me exactly who you are and how you want to be identified to make sure I get that right.
Okay. Well, I'm just Jimmy Fails. I'm just some guy from San Francisco that happened to make a movie. So that's pretty much it. I'm an actor and I'm a writer.
You made a movie that's getting some buzz.
I did. It's crazy.
What does that feel like?
It feels good to know that you can, you know, make your dreams come true with your best friend, really. I mean, that's it.
Your best friend is a director on this film, right?
Yes.
Jay,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some autobiography in here, right? I mean, this film is largely a story of your life dramatized.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're a San Francisco guy from way back.
Uh-huh.
Why'd you want to tell the story of that city then?
Because I love my city so much, really. I mean, and it's changing. So we have to document the part of the city that made us, or the part that we grew up in, the city that we saw.
This house that's at the center of this film,
mm-hmm.
What did it mean to you when you were a kid?
That's a great question. I mean, it's representative of ownership, black ownership, my grandpa owning that. It represents family. That's where most of, like, it was a big house in there. It was me, my dad, my aunt, my uncle, their kids, and, you know, it was like a neighborhood sort of house. When we lost the house, mm-hmm. It spread the whole family out. We never were really kind of back together, and mostly family.
Because this is a film about gentrification, and it's about change, and it's about wealth and race and class.
Mm-hmm.
You look at San Francisco now, man, what do you see?
What I don't see is black people that much. You know, I don't see diverse groups of friends even anymore. You know, I see coffee shops and cafes where corner stores used to be. I see just a bunch of new buildings, new construction, just new condos. And I mean, I'm sure, like, after this press tour, when I go back, it'll be different than before I left.
Do you feel out of place in the city you grew up in?
Yes, I do.
Which is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily your job, but you told this story, so I kind of have to ask you the question.
Sure.
What's the answer to what's happening to San Francisco?
Well, I mean, this is sort of a rallying cry in a way, this movie. I mean, all it is we just want to start a dialogue so that we can try to preserve those parts of the city that we feel make it what it is. So hopefully that even the people that are gentrifying can see it and become educated on San Francisco history or anything to know the culture and the way of life. And they can maybe understand it a little bit more.
So you are technically Jimmy Fails the fourth, right?
I am the fourth, yeah.
So if there's a Jimmy Fails the sixth, right? I mean, none of my business, but mm-hmm. let's use you have a grandson who's Jimmy Fails the sixth.
Sure.
What do you think San Francisco looks like for him?
We'll see. I mean, what I would want it to look like is a diverse melting pot that is San Francisco. So he can grow up and be well-versed in many different cultures, different backgrounds and walks of life. That's what I would want it to look like. What I think it would look like, I don't even want to think about what I think it would look like. It's gentrification is just violently rapid in San Francisco. Violently rapid.
Jimmy Fails. It's a film called Last Black Man in San Francisco. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, all credit to the food blog Grub Street. Kraft has gone just a hair too far, methinks, in trying to convince kids to eat their veggies. They've got a new product out, Kraft does. It's called Salad Frosting, packaged in a squeeze bag, decorated with colorful designs, nice and yummy looking. It's ranch dressing, you guys. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 43 points today, almost 0.2%. NASDAQ down 29 points. It's about 0.4% there. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, about 0.2%. Our media production team includes Sarah Brugere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostet, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.